Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkman, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Uli Halperin of Tel Aviv University. Hello and welcome to the program.
Hi, Raj, and thank you for having me.
So the many faces of a Himalayan goddess, brand new 2020 OUP publication, part of one of the American Academy of Religion series, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Title says everything and nothing all at the same time, which is why you needed to write the book. What is the topic of your book? Who is this Himalayan goddess you're writing about?
Yeah, that's a good question still, I guess. And I guess that the main thing that I've learned is that the question of who is the goddess, eventually I learned was not... the right question completely, but I guess I'll get to that the more we dive in. But to begin with, yeah, the question I started my research was to try and find out who this goddess known as Hidimba Devi, who is worshipped in basically all over Himachal Pradesh, but mainly in the area of the Kulu Valley of the... People might know it from the town of Manali, which is a famous tourist hub these days. So she has a rather famous temple these days in the area of Manali, in the northern part of the Kulu Valley. And I wanted to figure out who she was. And I embarked on this journey. Actually, it started a lot earlier. I can talk about it if you want, but the project aims at understanding who this goddess is, what she means for her people, what role does she play in their lives, and basically the whole complex, which is really Hidimba Devi.
We'll certainly dig into some of the data that you discover in trying to find out who this goddess is, and perhaps you are perhaps. The question remains, but nevertheless, you have found out a great deal about her. But why don't you share the story of how you embarked on this journey?
Yeah, well, it started in, I guess, in the mid-90s when it was, I'm from Israel, as you can figure out by the fact that I'm in Tel Aviv right now and was for the most of my life. And it was a custom, it still is to some extent, for young people in their 20s to, Israel is a very small place, so people go and travel and, you know, want to see the world. So basically there were two trends. There was the group of people going east and the group of people going to the west, namely to South America and places like that. And I went east. I guess it was closer and cheaper to fly, so this is...
Oh, maybe your vasanas were wired differently than theirs. Your inclinations.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't regret it. I still plan to go to South America one day, but you know, I don't regret the choice I made. And actually, I didn't land right away in India. I started with Thailand. I visited Vietnam and then went to Nepal. And only after 6 months of traveling, I arrived in India, in Varanasi, actually. because I was coming from Nepal, and from there I took it for almost a year. I traveled in India. Back then you could get a visa for up to 12 months, which was great. I bought myself an Enfield Bullet, you know, and drove around and had a great experience. And I guess that this trip had left, or it had three main outcomes for me, I would say. The first was that in terms of the encounter with India and with the culture and with religion, it was very hard for me to actually get my mind around it. Because every time I went to visit temples and I talked to people and I did, you know, what backpackers do. But it was very hard. You know, you would go into a Shiva temple and ask people what it is. What is it? What's going on in? Meaning, what is this religion? What is this that you're doing? You know, very big question. And they would just point at the Murti and say, this is Shiva. And I was left, okay, you know, what can I do with that? So this actually drove my curiosity about learning more. And when I came back to Israel and I decided to go to the university, I actually knew I want to go to the university before that. But before I left for my trip, I was actually enrolled to the law school. And I remember sometime during my visit to India, I called my parents and I said, I don't think law school is going to work for me. I'm going to go for the... for the other side of campus, and I landed in the philosophy department in the East Asia Studies department where I teach now. It's two departments. I had a double major, a BA degree, and I continued to MA in religious studies, and from there I went on to my PhD at Columbia University. And back then, during my studies in Israel, I was studying Sanskrit, and I was still very much philosophically and textually tuned. But when it came time for me to decide what I'm going to propose as my PhD thesis, you know, the famous statement of purpose, what are you going to do? It dawned on me that actually what I could do and would be very interesting is to talk about, suggest to study Hidimba Devi, because what happened is that when I was traveling in India for that year, I ended up staying in Manali with a local family in the village of Dhungri, which I will tell a bit more about later. And so I had some friends there on the ground, you know, which I kept in touch during the years, and I kept visiting. And I knew there was this goddess named Hidimba, which nobody really studied carefully up to that point. And I knew that she had some ties with the Mahabharata. She was considered a figure from the Mahabharata. And I knew that she was undergoing all sorts of changes. And it seemed to me like a very good idea to try and figure out. So this is what I proposed. And when I arrived at Colombia, this is exactly what I did. I studied and then conducted my 2 years of fieldwork for the PhD. And then a few other trips after that to expand the dissertation and turn it into a book. I added a few chapters, and that's the story. That's the story.
Well, it's a fascinating story. It's common and uncommon all at the same time. I'm reminded by my last interview on this podcast was actually I interviewed Jack Holly, whom you... speak about
who was my advisor.
So there are parallels to his draw to Vrindavan, you know. There's something enticing about the space, something enticing about the practices and the people and the culture that are so seemingly enmeshed in that very space. So this goddess, Hidimba, would you say she's a local goddess? You mentioned a tie to the Mahabharata, and for sure we'll flesh that out, if for nothing more than to indulge my textual propensities. But is this goddess local to this region of Himachal Pradesh, would you say?
Well, I have a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is yes. she is a local goddess. I think that the if we have to choose between the two poles of the spectrum, I would go for the local goddess. It is my impression that and I discuss it in one of the chapters of the book, basically the ties that the goddess has to the Mahabharata, and since when this connection was made, and how intensive it is and how it developed. But I think that in essence, and from what I experienced, the most of the characteristic of Hidimba is of a local goddess. The way she functions in rituals, the stories connected with her, the people that surround her and follow her are all a local. So her rise into I would even say pan-Indian fame is fairly recent. This particular goddess, the goddess that is enshrined in the temple in near Manali, that I made the focus of my research. And the reason I'm very careful about how to answer this question is that one of the things, and here we go back to the question of who the goddess is, which I started with. When I went to the field, I was under the impression that was also informed by things that I did read about her in colonial writings and in some scholars that mentioned here, some local scholars that work in Himachal that I managed to read and some other scholars that wrote about it. I was under the impression that Hidimba is a goddess who has several temples across Himachal Pradesh, that she is a sort of a unified entity, you could say, a persona that everyone perceives as a solid persona, as a unified person, you know, that has manifestations, as we know, that happens in India a lot. But what happened when I started exploring that and actually went and visited the different places in which Hidimba is worshipped in Himachal, I realized that it becomes very hard to draw the line and connect the dots of how each and every temple is really connected to the other, to what extent are the different narratives that are told about the different Hidimbas that are not even called Hidimbas in all the places. There is an issue of her name. What is her name? So she is called Hidimba currently in Manali, but people would say, but her local Pahari name is Hirma, which is how she is called in other places as well, but not necessarily so. When she's introduced to tourists these days, she's often introduced as Hidimba, because this is how she's usually goes in the epic text. So you have the question of how do you even draw the line, what goddesses are you put in the fold and decide that, okay, here is a manifestation of Hidimba and I will consider the stories that are told about her here and so on and so forth. But I soon realized that this is it's very hard to do. It's very hard to draw the line, and it's very hard to know how long these different Hidimbas were actually associated with one another. There were times that I thought that there are connections that are, you know, centuries old between two temples, and then it realized that it was a matter of two decades that the goddess in another temple, the Hidimba there decided that she wants to visit the Hidimba of Manali, and then the connection was made, and then everybody knew about it. But if you had come to the valley, I don't know, 40 years ago, it might have been that nobody had heard of this other Hidimba. So the question of how well associated these different manifestations and to what extent they are really a manifestation of the same thing, of the same persona, was something that I was growingly debating and questioning throughout my research. And in fact, eventually I realized that this is something I'm not sure I want to do. And hence the name of the many faces of the Himalayan goddess, meaning there is an idea that there is a persona behind all these faces, but at the same time, and I think this is very much acknowledged by the practitioners, by the followers of Hidimba herself, that she has different manifestations. She has different faces, which don't always necessarily cohere also. So the idea that there is multiplicity and unity, which is something that we know about Indian goddesses in general, but in a way that it's not necessarily a unity that produces multiplicity, but it is more of multiplicity that sometimes the different focal points unite and associate even for some time, and then you can tell a few stories about certain places and say, here is the goddess, and then in other contexts, in other times, under different circumstances, you have something different going on. And this whole complexity was something that I think we now call Harimba.
Well, the microcosm of the worship of this many-faced, multiplicitous goddess within the Kulu Valley and surrounding regions, this is not dissimilar from the macrocosm of Indian religion, mm-hmm. where blurred are the boundaries between the one and the many, between the regional and the transregional. And the scholarly impulse is obviously to trace the line of argument, trace the line of history. Our methods typically are predicated on causation. When you're looking at an ecosystem, you can't understand whether the flora causes the fauna or the fauna causes the flora. Mm-hmm. And so it's analogous to what I do with the Puranas, sort of to try to buck the trend of looking for the pristine earlier iterations, right? The authentic texts, as opposed to thinking of it as a textual tapestry that really defies that sort of linear quest. Nevertheless, the quest must ensue, and we must advance knowledge of these religious practices and advance knowledge of the goddess you have. Why don't you tell us about some of the data that you're looking at, some of the faces, some of the contours? What have you learned about this goddess?
Yeah, maybe just before that, I want to respond to what you just said, which I totally agree that, and it actually also relates to the second question. I think that what happens, for me, it happened ethnographically. For you as a textualist, it happened when you confront the text. I think that the basic or the initial understanding is that you're looking into something which is very messy. We tend to read articles and books about, you know, cultural and religious phenomena that are the product of many years of research, and what we read is handed to us in a very orderly manner, more or less, you know, depending on the writer. But we tend to think, when we only read about culture, that things are very organized and they have a beginning and a middle and an end and causality, just as you said. But when we actually start doing our own research, we realize that the reality is very messy. And trying to tell an organized story is something, first, that is very difficult and not necessarily even possible. And for me, I think that at some point I realized that it's also, it's not only unnecessary, but it's not right. Because I realized that the people that follow Harimba have no problem with the fact that she has these many faces that do not necessarily cohere. So, for example, in the chapter that I trace the origin narratives that are related to her, it becomes very quickly clear that this goddess is supposed to have come from different places. So there are stories about her coming from Tibet. There are stories about her coming from a lake in the upper end of the valley. There are stories about her coming from the southern part of the valley. And there are stories about her marrying other gods in other places. So, you know, when you try to tell a cohort, how would you do that? So at the beginning, I thought that I could maybe trace the history and build this sort of Purana, basically, right, which would be my own, telling the story, until I realized, why would I do that? Nobody on the ground is doing that. And if I do that, it would only be my own story. So what am I producing here? But on the other hand, I didn't just want to document everything that people tell me, you know, and just retaining the messiness, saying something along the lines of, I asked people, who is Harimba? And this is what they told me. And I throw all this, you know, messiness upon you. So I try to find a middle ground between keeping this multiplicity, the multifacetedness, the many stories, the many faces on the one hand, but still putting them in a framework that enables some sorts of analysis and meaning and order into this thing, which at the same time would be acceptable for her people, that they would not go over this book and say, we don't know this goddess that you invented. They could find familiar things in it and accept it. To the question of how did I, if I remember correctly, what kind of data, right? I got.
Yeah, just, yeah, because you know, in passing, you've mentioned perhaps some archival colonial data, perhaps some ritual observation, perhaps some textual accounts. You know, there's obviously, you're approaching the phenomenon from a variety of vantage points. And so maybe talk both about the vantage points and what those vantage points yield. What do you end up learning from each of these peepholes into this phenomenon? Do they serve to corroborate or to complicate each other? You know, I don't really have an answer in mind. I want to give you an opportunity to share what you're finding out about this goddess and how you're finding it out.
Yeah. Well, the question of the point of view to actually take was something that bothered me before I went to the field. And actually, I have a funny story about that, just to demonstrate how strong our biases or initial standing points might be. Before even starting my field research, I was very adamant that I don't want to tell a story from a point of view of the bird's eye point of view, right? I knew that I wanted to tell the story not from, that I did want to tell a story ground up, right? Hanging out with the people, seeing what they are saying and not trying to impose a sort of a narrative, not coming from the mob Harata, trying to figure out how Hadimba is living on the ground, but see, you know, grassroots level, what people are saying and to build the story from there. And I kept promising myself that I will stick to the people and I will, you know, I would actively look for the less knowledgeable informants. You know, we usually try and look for the smartest people around who are most knowledgeable, who can give us the whole, you know, the whole story ready made. But I actually and actively promised to myself that I would search these people at the end. And I will start exactly with the people who don't necessarily know all the bits and pieces and they just know the different perspective. However, when at some point there was a big buffalo sacrifice to the goddess, and I knew it's going to be a big fair and many people will come, I ended up finding myself climbing a rooftop of a storehouse, trying to do exactly what I try to avoid and find this vantage point that will allow me to see everything from above, you know, this godly-like perspective. And then I realized that I missed all the action on the ground because I was stressed between two people. I could barely see anything. I was so far away from everything. Luckily for me as a scholar, not for the buffaloes involved, but 2 years later, there was another buffalo sacrifice, which I implemented, you know, my findings from the first time. I was on the ground this time, and this was a totally different experience. But I'm saying all that to emphasize that what I did try to do is to exactly try and look at the goddess from this different vantage point. So I think that while I always kept the goddess, the question of who is this goddess, what can I learn about her? The perspective I took were different. So for example, one of the things I did almost every day was to go to the temple. I just spent a lot of time sitting in the temple, just, you know, seeing what rituals are being done, who are the people who are visiting, what do the pujaris say to these people, how do they conduct the affairs. So the place, you know, where the goddess is worshipped statically, was a major actor in my work. And I just took many notes about that. Another thing I did was to follow Hadimba's palanquin, the Ratta, the movable form of the goddess, which is very active and a very popular form of manifestation of deities and deities in the Himalaya in general. Simply a sort of palanquins or chairs that are decorated with all sorts of metal masks and jewelry and cloths and flowers that are carried on people's shoulder and taken from place to place. So this is the movable manifestation of the goddess. And in this form, the goddess travels to festivals and meeting other devtas. And so I just joined all these processions, you know, and got from this the vantage point on all the encounters of the goddess, how the goddess functions and behaves when she meets other gods, which is a huge thing about how she is defined in the ecosystem that she works in. Obviously, I talked to a lot of people, basically to everyone I could, you know, to starting from the priests to the people who carry the goddess, for a lot of people that had duties around the temples. I tried to talk to women as much as I could, you know, to have both genders perspective. I talked to kids, you know, I just sat with, I don't know, 10-year-old guys from the village and asked them what they thought about the goddess and got some of their views about that. And doing that, I tried to, on the one hand, gather as much as information as I could just to understand the system in general, you know, not just the religious aspects of it, but how the village works, how the agriculture works, how the social structures work, how tourism works, a lot of things that happen in the valley. And within that, to give a special focus to how the goddess behaves and is constructed and thought of and functions within all these contexts, and from there to take it to tell her story, or stories, actually.
Could you tell us a bit about the function of Hidimba? How does she function within the context in relation to the space or the supplicants?
Yeah, well, again, in a way, this is the question of the whole book, and I have different answers to it. But let me suggest two answers. One of them is concerns this ratta, this movable vehicle in which the goddess moves. And I think that in this capacity, the goddess is a sort of a social axis around which the whole community is built. Because the way it works, that several times a year, before the goddess goes and travels and to meet and other gods, her palanquin is actually being built. So it's being built and disassembled every time, even for a function of 2 or 3 days. So what you have is you have duty holders from coming from different castes in the village and different families on a role based, and they all contribute a part. So some people would build the chair, and some people would bring the flowers, and there were of course the bajantri, the players that would play the music. So every part of every social group in the village has its role around the goddess. So the fact that the goddess is constantly being built and rebuilt means that the community displays itself to itself several times a year, including the hierarchies and the mutual relations and all these sorts of things. So in that respect, the goddess functions as a social cohesion, a mechanism for social cohesion, for good and bad. So some people would be very happy with the fact that she keeps them in, you know, in their higher hierarchical role. Some other would be less happy about it, but at least this is how it works. So this is one thing, one way in which she functions, you could say, in the community. Another way, which I found very interesting, had to do with the weather issues. Actually, the fact that the weather was changing in the Kulu Valley, as it has been changing throughout the world. But in the Kulu Valley, actually, this was not something I was even considering studying before I came to the valley. But on my first day in the field, I met this the family that I mentioned before, that I befriended earlier. And the first thing they told me was that this was the first winter that Manali saw no snow. So the area was actually warming up. And this was on everybody's mind, like, what is going on? And what was fascinating for me to see how people interpret people do three things together with the goddess when they think about this situation. First, they interpret it from the perspective of the goddess. So they ask themselves, who is the agent working behind this weather change? Is the goddess angry with us? What have we done? Have we become too greedy? Have we forgotten our duties? You know, things like that, that people are trying to figure out or interpret the change while thinking about it through the eyes or through the perspective of the goddess being in charge of it. And then there is the thing of how they use the goddess to engage it. So there are all sorts of mechanisms, ritual mechanisms, like the buffalo sacrifice, like all sorts of processions and all sorts of things, ritual procedures that the community is trying to perform in order to counter drafts and to make sure that the sun shines on time and, you know, that the snow doesn't come at the wrong time and ruins the apple crops and things like that. So again, the goddess was there as a focal point in thinking how to engage that. And then on the third level, there were doubts at some point, at least for some people, that maybe the fact that the while it seemed that while the rituals were working locally, I mean, like in a certain time, like when they needed rain, they would do the ritual, and amazing as it may sound, it often worked, and I could see it with my own eyes, you know, how rain was coming when they needed it and how it stopped when they didn't. But if you look at it in a more expansive time frame, people were definitely saying that the area was warming up gradually and that the weather changes, the weather patterns were changing in a way that started making them doubt on some levels the power of the gods to even change it. So ideas about how global warming is working and how the logic of science is actually behind, they can explain what is going on and not necessarily the logic of faith in the goddess and things like that. So that was the third arena, which you could say that people thought with the goddess about what was going on. So to sum it up, it helped, the goddess helped them interpret what is going on, the goddess helps them engage with what is going on, and the goddess finds herself in a position that people may begin to doubt her powers following what is going on. So in a more reflective way, this is the role she took in her in their lives as well, engaging new realities, thinking about them, trying to figure out how to understand them, what to do about them, how to figure their own place within that. So all these things were happening around the goddess and within the ritual and conceptual spaces that talking about the goddess, doing things for the goddess opened up and enabled.
So within this regional context, Hidimba is, let me process this as a question better than a statement. Is Hidimba not the prime divine agent? Is she not the supreme face of divinity? Is she not the most powerful agent, or would there be other gods that would have that role as well?
That's a good question. Depends on who you ask. No doubt that Hidimba is considered one of the more powerful goddesses in the region, by everyone in the valley, by the way, from people from the village itself, other villagers, from the a royal family in the town of Kulu that still worships her. And so she is considered a very powerful agent, a very powerful divine figure in the valley. But there are others as well. There is Bijli Mahadev, who is a form of Shiva that is worshipped near the town of Kulu and is considered a very powerful god. And there are others. And there are a lot of arguments sometimes. I was at some point, I remember there was I saw a meeting between, I was sitting with one of my friends, Parasram, a local guy, a follower of the goddess Hidimba, and a guy from another part of the valley who is a follower of Bijli Mahadev arrived there, and he saw me asking questions about the goddess. So he intervenes in the conversation and asks, what are you studying? What are you doing? And I said, I'm interested in the gods in the valley. And he said, oh, so you should study Bijli Mahadev, who is the supreme god of this valley. And then Parasram, which hears that, he says, no, friend, Hadimba is the supreme deity, you know, of the place. And then it didn't turn into an argument, but into a debate, let's say, like that. And eventually they settle on our elders say different things, you know. So each village has its own role. And there is another level. There is the level of Bhagwan, you know, that there are more supreme gods, that, you know, the pan-Indian gods like Shiva and Parvati, that everyone are aware of the fact that there are greater gods, you know, in India. The Hadimba is considered herself a sort of manifestation of Durga and Kali. So, okay, this was a very not so organized answer to your question, but I think that on the ground, Hadimba is considered definitely a major agent and a major power, definitely for her people. But at the same time, there is an acknowledgement that there are other powers, and that there are powers on higher level and the pan-Indian level that are working. They are very powerful, and they can manipulate things also, and also influence how Hadimba is acting.
Among her devotees, is there not a self-consciousness about the fact that she is a local goddess, that she is a goddess of this space tied to the Himalayas? Is there that understanding? And in responding to that, maybe you can say something about the tension between regional and trans-regional religion that your book illumines, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, for her people, she is definitely a local goddess, in the sense that she is very, I think that first and foremost, she is tied to her temple, and she is tied to her Ratha that is traveling 40 kilometers south of Manali. That would be the limit. So she has her territory, which she circumambulates once a year, and she has regions she cannot go into the valley. There is a whole mechanisms, and the sovereignty divides between each god is in charge of different territory. So she's very much tied to the territory. She's very much tied to the people. Her stories, the many stories about her, tie her to the place. So I think the weather that she controls is very local. Which means that when people say that she's powerful and she controls the weather, usually they don't mean that she can control the weather in Delhi, but she can control the weather in the Kulu Valley. So on a very basic and fundamental level, this is how she is perceived. However, there are different levels that expand the imagination of what the scope of this goddess really is. So, for example, she is identified as a form of Durga, as in a form of Kali, which lends her, by definition, a wider scope. But there are even stories about how she. There is a famous story in the valley about how she toppled Indira Gandhi. After the emergency period, she stopped the emergency. There's a big story that her shaman predicted that the emergency is going to be over, and then everyone woke up, and the day after, and it was announced in the news. So Hadimba also has this capacity to change the reality beyond the valley. And I even had the followers telling me before I left the field that I should be careful not to think that Hadimba is only in charge of Manali, and once I leave the territory, then I can do whatever I want and no longer respect her in my writing and, you know, talking about her. So I should always remember that she can, you know, if I misbehave, she can hit me wherever I am. which is an advice that I have to remember to admit that I remember to this day, very careful about what I say, try to, you know, do my best in saying what is.
So the tactic worked. The tactic was effective then.
The tactic was effective, definitely. It works. It not only worked, it still works, even in this conversation.
The power of Hidimba.
Yeah, the power of Hidimba. But I think that to your question, I think that the place that we see the interaction with larger narratives and between the regional and the pan-Indian or the extra-regional is the identification or the identification of Hidimba as a character from the Mahabharata. Because I try and trace, today, if you're a tourist today and you arrive in Hidimba temple in Manali and you enter the temple and you ask, who is this goddess? You will get the answer, this is Hidimba of the Mahabharata, Bhimki Patni Ghatotkach Ki Ma, the wife of Bhima from the Mahabharata and the mother of Ghatotkach, two famous, of course, characters from the Mahabharata. And this is the answer you would get. And I tried to find out for how long was this situation. And here is the place, one of the places, again, and there aren't too many texts in the region, and it's very hard to find concrete data. And I couldn't find a straight answer to this question. There are some indications that show that this connection, this association is pretty old, at least several hundred years old. It was there on some capacity. But then on the other hand, there are indications that even like, I don't know, less than 80 years ago, 70 years ago, there were people who knew the goddess very well and wrote about her and never bothered to mention any association with the Mahabharata. So the way I decided I'll approach that is that it is safe to assume that the association was there, but that for a few reasons that I trace in the book, they have been foregrounded in the past several decades. And I think that what made this association take the front seat, especially in the past two or three, now a bit more, three or four decades, were two things. First, the rise of tourism to the region in the late 80s and 90s. So the Kulu Valley was discovered by hippies in the 60s, you could say, where people started traveling to the valley, but the hike in tourism to the region started more or less in the late 80s and 90s, where the trouble in Kashmir started. So people didn't want to go there so much, so they started shifting and to the Kulu Valley, and then, you know, roads were built, so it was more accessible. And what happened at the same time was that in the late 80s, the famous series of the Mahabharata, the TV series, was broadcasted in Doordarshan. So what you had is a convergence of people watching the TV series at home and then starting to travel with the story in their mind, very vivid, you know, and present with the huge effect that the TV had in India. And then they are come to Manali and they realize that there is a goddess here that is named Hidimba. So for the pujaris and for the people involved with the goddess, it became the easiest and made most sense to present her as that figure, because it was simply known. It made everything much easier to say, yeah, this is the goddess, this is the character from the Mahabharata. However, while it made life very easy in terms of making her familiar, they still had to face the problem that in the epic, she's a demon, right? She's a demoness, she's a rakshasi, And here you have a goddess that is very familiar, but she's a familiar as a demon, a demoness, which created other problems. And then started one of the most fascinating things for me to find out, and that I couldn't imagine before, how the local narrative building kicked in and started to transform the story, not in the sense that it says Hadimba was not a Rakshasi, which was the easy way to go, right? You could say, no, she's actually, she wasn't a Rakshasi, or just, you could distance her from the epic. But the people actually chose to say, yes, she is a Rakshasi. She is a very primordial powers, you know, and jungly powers. However, they said there are parts missing from the Mahabharata about how she eventually turned into a goddess. And there are stories in the region about how Hadimba, after the Mahabharata, approached Krishna and told him, you know, what about me? I married Bhim that deserted me. I mothered Ghatotkach that died in the war. So what about me? And then, according to the local narratives, Krishna promises her that if she meditates in the temple in Manali, she could turn into a goddess, into a Kali, and she would reign supreme during the Kali Yuga. There is a sort of a confusion there between the Kali and the Kali Yuga. Let's leave that aside. But the interesting thing is that this narrative is now told to tourists, and it, if you ask me, becomes part of the living Mahabharata, because people that are coming back from Manali or that sit outside the temple, and I sometimes pretended to be a clueless tourist asking them, who is this goddess, you know, and what is it, told me the exact stories they just heard in the temple. You see, so you have here a sort of a ground-up Sanskritization. It's deshification, right? It's how the local narratives reconstruct or reshape the more pan-Indian narratives and make their way up. So this on this interplay between the local narratives and the pan-Indian narrative, that Hadimba is situated, and I think she draws from both of them and affects both of them. And maybe if I may, one more word. At some point, a friend of mine from Manali sent me a link to a Netflix series. It's called Kahi Suni. I don't think it was broadcast in the Indian television, one of the channels, and then made its way to a Netflix. And it's a series about local mythologies in India. So each episode goes to another place and tells the stories, the local narratives that can be found about different gods and goddesses. And one of the episodes was about Hadimba. And the story that was portrayed there was the story told in Manali. And there were actors acting Hadimba and Krishna, so you could actually see a new episode makes its way into the Mahabharata on, you know, national TV, and then on Netflix with subtitles in Hebrew. So for me, that was a very, you know, a globalized effect of how local stories make their way to global stages.
You must have been a kid in a candy store watching that Netflix.
Yeah, definitely.
So this gimmick you adopted about the pretense of being the clueless tourist. I can tell you, I know exactly what you mean, because it's sort of what I do on this podcast. So what's your book about? How did you study that? but it can yield quite fruitful responses.
We have to be actors, right? I think that one of the things I learned about ethnography by being in the field, that acting is part of it. I had to be amazed over and over again from hearing the exact same stories, but from different people, you know, because you sit with someone, you ask them who the goddess is, and you hope to get some new information, some new angle, but they always start with the same, you know, a few narratives, and you have to be, wow, really? I've been here in the village for a year, and this is like the 300th time that I hear this story, but I'll still make myself very much amazed to encourage you to tell me more, you know. So I think
that's great.
But this is fun.
So there's two tensions that you talk about that I think are so pervasive in goddess traditions. The tension between the local and the pan-Indian, and also the tension between what we may think of as the divine versus the demonic. You know, you have... the first time you had a goddess enter the Sanskrit world, I mean, capital G goddess through the Devi Mahatmya. She's, you know, she's Vindhyavasini, right? Mm-hmm. She's, you know, there are in a number of the stotrams, she's praised as Mahadevi and Mahasuri, you know, the great goddess, the great demoness. And there's something about, something specific about the texture of the feminine divine, especially in South Asia, I find, that lends itself to this kind of textured paradox where she's supreme. So she, yes, she's local and she's everywhere. She's all power. So she's a good power and she's, you know, she's the light side and the dark side of the force all at the same time. And one wonders if, one wonders at the ancient cult of Durga that started off probably something much similar to what we see with Limba. Now in every crevice of Hindutam, Durga is worshipped. And she's tantamount to the supreme divine principle in feminine form. But, you know, it's studies like this that make you wonder how much of ancient Durga worship is comparable to what we see in the Kulu Valley. But enough, I won't wax too poetically because then I can't keep up the clueless tourist ruse. So so one of the things, in speaking with the tension of local and panindic and the tension of Brahmanical versus, you know, regional or village religion or folk religion or popular religion in the technical sense, the Devi Hidimba happily accepts blood, animal sacrifice. Yet, it appears to be the case that some within the valley are not so happy for her to accept that sacrifice. And I bring this up because you have a chapter dedicated to this fascinating topic. What have you learned about this?
Oh, yeah, this is definitely one of the most charged issues surrounding Hidimba. And it very much relates to this question of you raised about the two sides of the goddess, the demonic and the divine. I would say, okay, let me put it this way. There is definitely a struggle these days between people who think that animal sacrifice to the goddess is part of her tradition. It is part of what she expects. Though people would confine that a little bit, saying, listen, the gods and the goddess, they don't really need anything from us. If they want anything from us, it's just flowers, right? It's flowers in the sense that something that you don't even, you just need to put some work into that. You know, you need to go and find some flowers and then give it to the goddess. She doesn't, there is a sense there that what we give to the, what we choose to give to the gods and the goddesses, it's something that has to do not so much with what they need, but what we need as their followers in order to create this connection with them. Having said that, there is obviously, or at the same time, this notion that Hidimba is a Rakshasi, is a demon, is a sort of a being that has one root, one leg, if not two legs, in the jungle, and that she needs her blood sacrifices, and if not, she will be very angry with us, right? So some people blame bad weather conditions for not doing sacrifices, and they're very much stand very firm against any attempt to abolish or to ban animal sacrifice. At the same time, there are other people who are vegetarians who are adopting notions that some of them are, you can find them traditionally in the Kulu Valley. Some of them are coming with the influences from the outside. Some of them come with tourism and modernity. And recently with the internet, you know, the fact that you have tourists taking videos in their mobile phones of animal sacrifice and then post them on social media, it is out of context. It definitely doesn't look good. And then it draws a lot of criticism, you know, so it makes people feel uncomfortable. So you also have a group of people standing against that. I think that what I found most fascinating about that is that people did not let go easily of the notion that blood sacrifices are not only necessary, but something that should be seen as a marker of local identity. There is something, there is a certain roughness about this, about rawness about this, this wildness about this act, that I think that people also identify with themselves. It is a peripheral act. It is something that is not mainstream, and it is acknowledged, but at the same time, it has a lot of power in it. So something you don't just, you know, say, okay, people don't like it, so we won't do it. But you realize that there is something both in the ritual act itself that is very powerful, and in what it stands for and what how it characterizes yourself as a person that stands at the periphery but holds to this, has access to these very powerful sources of very intensive sources of a power. And there is a great debate, and there was a ban issued by the Himachal Pradesh High Court against animal sacrifice, and it went up to the Supreme Court in India, that eventually said that it should not be banned because it's a traditional practice, and it would be it would be an act against the religious freedom of the people. But it's very debatable, but it is still going on. But I think that what happened after the ban is that it is not as public as it used to be. So people are more aware of the fact that it should not be publicized. And when I'm saying that, it is very important for me to emphasize that at least with some people I talk with, it's not only because of fear. So the idea is not just, okay, the outsiders, the Nichewale, as they call them, you know, the people who come from below, from the plains, it's not only that they don't like it and therefore we need to do it chup-chup, we need to do it quietly so nobody knows about it. It's a way of just avoiding the law, you know, or the criticism. But there is also the idea that what happened because of tourism and because of people coming from the outside, and some of them finding this ritual very fascinating, it started to draw a lot of attention, which caused locals to start fleshing it with it, you know, we'll do a bigger buffalo sacrifice. We'll sacrifice more sheep. We have more money to put into that. So as one person, which I quote in length, the book told me that it became more about me, about the self, right, than about the goddess. People were starting to flesh their money and to show their, to use animal sacrifice to basically show how, you know, their own status, instead of thanking or worshiping or catering for the goddess. And this ban, some of them say, was this Supreme Court ban was actually the working of Harimba, working behind the scene to find a way to remind her own people that it went overboard, that the whole understanding of what animal sacrifice should be got a bit out of hand and out of focus and away from its traditional meaning. And this reminded the people what it is all about, that it should be quiet, it should be within the family, within the village, and not something that you publish over the internet to draw tourists and make money off. But it is still going on. It's a fascinating...
There are so many, many fascinating threads about this topic. I mean, she goes without saying to anyone who listens to this program or has any sense of what we do at the Academy, or certainly, you know, how we roll as people, there is no judgment on our end. We are observing the data and understanding how people relate to these practices. And so just so that's clear, I find it endlessly fascinating. I had an experience in, I think 2009 was the first time I got to visit this place called India, this in this life anyhow. these vasanas have to come from somewhere, yes. But yeah. But you know, I'm personally squeamish about, for example, if I see roadkill, I have to look the other way. Animal slaughter, I can't do it at all. So I was shocked that I was in a temple in, I think it was Kamakya. And I was shocked because I saw this, the head of a buffalo and a bird and some flowers. And it was so exquisitely and ornately laid out. I had this sort of epiphany in that moment. I neither endorse nor discourage animal sacrifice. That's between you and your gods. That's between you and Hidimba. But I had this moment where something that would be gruesome to me was somehow supplanted by this sort of rich, ornate expression of offering on this platter. And it sort of blew my mind. And for a moment, in that moment, I understood something very, very deep and powerful about that process of making an offering of that sort. Anyhow, there's much more to be said about that. Oh, the other word that comes to mind, for some reason, the word occult comes to mind, because occult literally means that which is hidden. Mm-hmm. And so these practices whereby one is supposed to derive tremendous spiritual power, or at very least tremendous favor with the devata, those very powerful practices are, at least in this context, the most hidden practices. Practices that should be shielded from the public eye. So this, I mean, there's so much fascinating content there. I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole. was there anything about the book that you hoped we'd touch on before we close?
Well, we touched a lot about a lot of things, which is good. You know what? Maybe I'll use that to just talk a bit about my where do I go from here, because it emerges in a way from
that. Just so you know, that's almost always my last question. So let's pretend. So what are you working on next? Where do you go from here?
excellent question, Raj. Excellent questions. It came just the right time. Well, my next project emerges, I think, from the first chapter, basically. The first chapter that I begin the book is with the Ratha. Because I think that in many ways, this is the most vivid manifestation of the goddess, even more than the one in the temple. Because actually, most of the people, the locals, I mean, the villagers, meet their goddess more in the form of the moving Ratha than in the temple. So people obviously go to the temple on different occasions, but the fact that the rat may come out and travel 20, sometimes 30 times a year and move through the lanes of the village means that the movable, this movable murti, this movable form is something that they encounter much more. And I think that working on this chapter, which is the first but one of the chapters I added later in the project, has drawn my attention to the materiality of it all. I think that just walking in the village and seeing all the devtasthans, you know, all these small places where little gods are enshrined under trees and identified as rocks and with all sorts of stages like platforms and things like that. When your attention is turned to the material and spatial aspects of lived religion everywhere, I think, but in India and in North India in particular, you realize that you are sharing your space with a lot of entities, a lot of spirits and devtas and bhutas. If you go into the forest, you know, all kinds of bhut pret kind of creatures, and they are all manifested materially. Like they can have many forms, of course, but they are manifested and they take form manually. And the way they are And they can be found everywhere, from your home, in your home shrine, right? And to your yard with the small shrine you built to your home, to your cool devta, to your family devta in the yard, and then to the lanes of the village where you have sort of small public shrines, and to the bigger temples, and to the forest temples. So basically everywhere you go, from the inside of your home to the forest, you go through different manifestations of gods and goddesses and all sorts of other creatures. And I find this question fascinating, just trying to understand how the fact that this is all so very material, how this, that the things are present around you and they shape the way you occupy the space and move through it, and how it grabs your attention. You know, walking from the place I lived in the village to Hardimba Temple meant that I went through, I don't know, several places, Devtasthan, and each of them has its own little ritual. You know, you touch here and put your hand to your chest, and here you fold your hands, and here you give something. So your whole daily routine is like, in a way, choreographed around these places. So I'm going to look deeper into that. And this is something that comes up in the book. It starts coming up in the book, but I hope to explore it. If I can go to India again soon, because this has become a challenge, right? Learning and studying material religion in a place that you cannot fly into. It's a problem, but I hope it's solved.
For the many benefits of the internet, whereby we can have this podcast recording take place, myself located in Toronto, yourself in Israel, you cannot study the Himalayan region over the internet. No. Perhaps elements thereof.
It won't be as fun, that's for sure.
Exactly. We need to both satisfy your intellectual curiosity and your travel lust simultaneously.
Exactly.
It's been great speaking with you. Thank you for joining us today.
Raj, thank you very much for having me here.
You're most welcome. So for those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Ehud Halperin of Tel Aviv University on his brand new 2020 publication, The Many Faces of a Himalayan Goddess, subtitled Hardimba, Her Devotees, and Religion in Rapid Change. Until next time, keep listening, keep reading, keep thinking, and perhaps take the time to contemplate the many faces of the goddess.